This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Most of us have experienced this at one time or another, a moment of pure clarity, of insight, when the answer to a problem seemingly comes out of nowhere. Helen Keller suddenly understood the concept of language as Anne Sullivan poured water over her hand while tracing the letters for water on the other hand. The aha moment can also produce a striking creative burst, as in 50 years ago when Paul McCartney awoke with the melody to Yesterday just playing in his head. Less dramatically, perhaps, most of us have experienced eureka moments, which are more often than not followed by a sense of joy. This hour, we explore what happens in the brain during flashes of insight and how to cultivate that ability. Our guest is neuroscientist John Cunyos, who together with Mark Beeman has written The Eureka Factor, Aha Moments, Creative Insight, and the Brain. John is also director of Applied Cognitive and Brain Sciences and professor in the Department of Psychology at Drexel University. Welcome, John.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So this is fascinating stuff. Let's start at the beginning. Why did you and fellow neuroscientist Mark Beeman decide to explore what's happening in the brain during an aha moment? And this was despite skepticism in the scientific community that the brain was doing anything special to produce these moments of clarity.
Well, aha moments, or insight as psychological scientists call them, they've been studied for off and on for over 100 years. And there seem to be good evidence that this is a unique form of cognition, a unique form of creativity. But there have always been skeptics within the scientific community that what we call an aha moment is really just normal thinking, business as usual, with a little bit of an emotional flourish at the end so that you feel that it's significant, but that it's really not any different from ordinary thought. So this was a topic that was ripe for applying neuroimaging to, because the 100 years of research on insight was all just studying behavior, people's behavior, animals' behavior, posing puzzles and problems to people. And it's very difficult from just studying behavior to determine whether an aha moment really is qualitatively different from other forms of thought. But if you can get inside the brain and see what's happening, then you can really see, is there something unique, a unique neural signature to aha moments that you don't find when people solve problems in a more mundane way? And that's why Mark Beeman and I got interested in this topic back in the very late 1990s. Well, actually, we had both done some behavioral research on insight before that. But as neuroimaging techniques, brain imaging techniques started to really take off, we thought that this would be a really, you know, ripe time to look at this particular question.
So what do you use then to map this moment in the brain, and what do you see?
Well, we use two different neuroimaging techniques. One is functional MRI, fMRI, which is a little bit different from the typical MRI, you know, when you hurt your shoulder and you go and you get a scan. The typical MRI, the standard MRI, just takes a picture of what's going on, a picture of the structures. But functional MRI maps patterns of blood flow in the brain, and it can tell you what parts of the brain are working hardest at a given time.
Okay.
And you get these exquisitely beautiful maps of what areas of the brain are particularly active. What it's not good at is telling you exactly when something's happening in the brain. So it tells you where, but it's not really good at telling you when. The other technique we use is EEG, electroencephalogram. And many people have had an EEG, but we use special high-density EEG, lots and lots of electrodes. And what that's really good at is telling you when something's happening in the brain, not so much where. It's more modest about its ability to tell you where something's happening in the brain, but it's really good at telling you when. So we combine these two techniques to see where and when an aha moment occurs in the brain.
Yes. So what do you see then when somebody has one of these revelations?
Well, we can't study actual life-changing revelations or epiphanies because, you know, you could go find someone and wait for them to have some, spiritual epiphany or come up with a new theory in physics and then try to stuff them in a brain scanner. That would be a very difficult task to do. You need lots and lots of these. So what we did is we used little verbal puzzles, and we have dozens and dozens of these little verbal puzzles. And sometimes people can solve them with an aha. Sometimes they solve them by just sort of methodically, deliberately working through the solution. And we looked separately at solutions where they solve it with this flash of insight, and other times when they solve them in a deliberate, methodical way. And we looked at the different brain areas and found that the thing that really jumped out was that at the moment of the aha, there's an area of the brain just above the right ear in the right temporal lobe that flashes very distinctly, high-frequency brain waves. And that is the neural signature of the aha moment.
So you see a flash when that realization is happening, when somebody gets it.
Yes, absolutely. But that's not the only thing we saw. We were a little surprised that just before that flash, there was a different flash in the back of the brain, in the visual centers of the brain. Now, strangely enough, you'd think that the visual centers of the brain would be up front where the eyes are, but that's not the way it works. The visual cortex is in the back of the brain. Go figure it. But what we found was just before the aha flash in the right temporal lobe, visual cortex sort of briefly shuts down. We call this a brain blink. And to understand how this works, you know, when you ask somebody a difficult question and you look at their face, often what they do is they look away or they close their eyes or they look up or down at their feet. They try to avoid visual information because it's distracting. And by cutting off that visual information, they're able to more easily figure out the solution to a problem or retrieve something from memory.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're saying that you were seeing on the scanners that there it shows in the back of the brain that you're not really focusing on anything visually, and then comes the flash over the right ear.
Exactly. So even if you don't look away, your brain is briefly blinking. And that seems to provide the impetus, you know, that moment of isolation from the environment makes it easier to find the unconscious solution to the problem and allow it to bubble up into awareness.
So is the brain operating on two different tracks? In other words, aha moments aren't, they don't happen in a vacuum. You're not just thinking about nothing and then all of a sudden they happen. Sometimes they interrupt conscious thought, correct?
Absolutely. In fact, that's almost the definition of an aha moment, where the solution to a problem or a new idea or a new perspective intrudes on your ongoing thought very abruptly and very suddenly. So yes, there are unconscious processes that are going on beneath the surface that bubble up all of a sudden and break into awareness and provide that new idea, new solution to a problem, new perspective, new way of looking at things.
So the brain is multitasking.
In a way, yes. It's not multitasking in the sense that, you know, when a person is trying to drive and talk on their cell phone at the same time, because both of those are conscious activities. You really can't do more than one thing consciously at the same time. But unconsciously, your brain is doing a lot of information processing at the same time as you are consciously working through something.
And how is this connected with dreams?
That's a really great question, and there is no good answer to that because we don't really know for sure what dreaming is, and we don't really know for sure what sleep is. But we do know that sleep itself helps people to solve problems, and it probably does this by transforming your memories, the information you have. So, for example, when you learn something during the day, it goes into a sort of a temporary fragile form in your brain. And then during sleep, that memory, that information and memory becomes consolidated. It's sort of like, think of cement. You pour it, and initially it's soft, and you can deform it. You could put a footprint in it. And then after hours go by, it hardens, and it's strong. During sleep, memories, which are initially soft, but they're hardened. They become consolidated. But during sleep, your memories are also transformed. The knowledge you have changes to bring out detailed and hidden relationships. And that's why often people wake up in the middle of the night with a new perspective, a new idea, a solution to a problem, or they get that idea as soon as they wake up in the morning. Those mental processes actually help to bring out the hidden relationships that are the stuff of insight and creativity.
So it's interesting to note that even while you're not conscious of it, your brain is working away subconsciously on
all the
things.
All the time.
So we're going to get to how you can actually develop the ability to have more aha moments, which can be good for business, good in your personal life, obviously. But first, let's talk a little bit about people, because some people are more likely to have them. You call them insightfuls, and other people are analysts. So get into that a little bit. Define those, if you will, for us.
People have different cognitive styles. Some people like to work through problems in a very deliberate, straightforward, methodical way, and they come to a solution. And these people tend to be very focused and very organized. Other kind of people, you might call them creatives. We call them insightfuls. They tend to be often a little bit scattered, a little bit fuzzy in their thinking. They might even be kind of all over the place and just different ideas pop into their heads. And those types of people tend to solve problems more with a flash of insight, a sudden idea that snaps everything into perspective. Now, nobody is a pure analyst, and no one is a pure insightful. Almost everyone we've tested can do both. But some people tend more towards one end of the scale and others more towards the other end of the scale. So you might think of it as, think of a person's weight. Genetics determines a set point, a weight to which you tend to gravitate. But that set point can be changed. If you exercise and you eat well and you sleep, you take care of yourself, your set point, your weight will go down. If you eat bad food, a lot of food, you don't exercise, don't sleep, then your set point goes up and then your weight goes up. So this scale of cognitive style, we think, is sort of like that. People have a natural point. They tend to be analysts or insightful, but there are things that can push them around, slide them around on that scale to make them more analytical or more insightful. And these are things that can even be manipulated in the environment to help slide you in one direction or the other.
And so are analysts, are their brains cooking along subconsciously at the same rate as insightfuls?
Well, that's hard to know. I mean, the only way we know what a brain is doing consciously is through what it produces. Mm. I mean, what kind of behavior is going on. It could very well be that the analysts have the same unconscious processes, but those things tend not to burst into awareness in the way it would for an insightful. Maybe they have more of a barrier between the unconscious and conscious minds, but we don't really know that for sure at this point.
Interestingly, you say that when somebody has an aha moment, that's often accompanied by a sense of joy, perhaps a little bit of euphoria. Why is that? And is that mappable in the brain? Do you see a color on the scanner when that happens?
Actually, it is. We've done some neuroimaging research on this topic. And, you know, people tend to think of thought and emotion as being separate things in the brain. But they're really not. Thought and emotion are so intertwined in the brain that you can hardly disentangle them. So we know, for example, that when a person is in a positive, a happy mood, or an anxious mood, or a depressed mood, it certainly affects cognitive processes like memory and perception. But it also affects problem solving. When you're in a positive mood, you tend to think in a more risky style. You tend to think in a more creative style. You take chances.
Oh, that's
all
okay.
Right. Well, we'll pick up on that.
You heard that music.
Yes.
We're up against a break, but we will continue this conversation in just a moment. We're talking about the brain science behind eureka moments, why they're important in the business world, personally, how to cultivate them. That's all ahead here on Radio Times. John Cunios is co-author of The Eureka Factor, and the number to call is 888-477-9499. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. And our subject this hour is the aha moment. Neuroscientist John Cunios and a colleague have mapped exactly what happens in the brain when it produces moments of insight and clarity. And he has some advice for us as to help our brains produce more of the same. John is co-author of The Eureka Factor, Aha Moments, Creative Insight, and the Brain. And lines are open at 888-477-9499. If you like, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet works just as well at WHYY Radio Times. So, John, how important is insight to economic growth?
Insights provide new ideas, new perspectives. They've been the source of inventions, things like frozen food, things like the television were all inspired by sudden insights. So insights are arguably very important as a form of creativity. They're very important to innovation in the economy. Now, of course, it's not just innovation. I mean, for economic success, there also has to be good, solid analytical thought. And it's actually the combination of these two things, both the creativity and the analytical thought, that together take a new idea and then refine it, verify it, test it to turn it into some great product or new system or new company. So you do need both, but without the initial insight, without that idea, you don't have much to work with.
So let's talk about the workplace then and how workplaces can enhance the probability that you will have more of these insights. You say that a workbeat that fosters an upbeat atmosphere might well be the successful workplace, and you kind of alluded to that a little bit earlier. How, again, tell us about how an upbeat atmosphere plays into the creation of insight.
When people are in a positive mood, it literally expands the scope of thought. It expands your attention so that you adopt sort of a riskier intellectual style. You're willing to consider long shot ideas, crazy ideas, things that don't seem immediately relevant, but which could be a new idea, a solution to a problem. But when you're in an anxious mood, even we're talking about a slight degree of anxiety, that puts on mental blinders. You focus on one or two prominent things in the environment. You don't consider those long shot ideas. Anxiety makes you a good analyst. It makes you good at methodical, deliberate thought, but it makes you bad at creative, innovative thought. So now you need to, as I said, you need to have both. You need to have the methodical thought and the creative thought in the workplace, but you want to keep those separate. If you really want innovations, it's very easy to stifle that creative mindset, that insightful mindset, by having an anxious workplace. So you want to create a space where people can be happy, be relaxed, be open to these crazy ideas. And once that mindset is established, it's very fragile. It's very easy to crush it. So you need to let it exist in blocks of time for people to have these ideas.
You say an open, expansive space, almost like the outdoors, is a workplace that's preferable, workplace environment that's preferable.
Yes. There seems to be a link between what we call perceptual or visual attention and conceptual attention. So, for example, if you're in a closet-like cubicle and your attention can't expand to encompass the space, then your thinking becomes narrow also. But if you're in a big room with large ceilings or you're outside, your attention naturally expands to fill the space, and that also expands the scope of your thought to incorporate new ideas, to consider new possibilities. And also, if there are striking objects around that grab attention, let's say you have a letter opener on your desk that looks like a dagger, even that can look vaguely threatening, cause a slight degree of anxiety, and grab and narrow your attention. And that will put you in an analytical frame of mind, but and will stifle insightful thought.
You quote Aaron Sorkin, who's creator of, among other things, The West Wing, is saying, "Writer's block is my default position. When I'm able to write something, that's when something weird is going on." And Sorkin's technique to remove writer's block is to take several showers a day, because it's during those showers that ideas come to him. Now, obviously, showers are an enclosed space, but there's something visual. I guess it's bland in a shower. Perhaps that helps him to come up with his ideas.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost become a cliche that people get great ideas in the shower. But, you know, it's true. And probably the reason that it's true is that in the shower, the water's warm. You don't really feel the boundary between your body and the air outside. So you feel this kind of expanse in the sense that you don't feel your body. There's white noise. What you see is kind of blurry. So it's like sensory deprivation. And in that kind of circumstance, your attention is directed inwardly and expands. And that is just a great environment for having insights. Even though the space is narrow, psychologically, it's an expansive experience.
So John Cunyas, I guess, does the technology we're tethered to squelch eureka moments?
Oh, absolutely. To solve problems with insight or come up with new ideas, you need to have time to incubate ideas. I remember reading an article, I think it was in the New York Times a number of years ago. It was about a mathematician, I believe, at Princeton University. And they asked him what he does during his typical day. And he said, you know, if someone could watch me all during the day, they would be horrified. They'd think I don't do anything because I spend a lot of time walking around. I take long baths or showers. I take long walks. I just sit over meals for hours and hours, and it looks like I'm not doing a thing. But I need that time because there are ideas constantly churning unconsciously in my brain, and without that, I wouldn't come up with any ideas. So having, you know, these smartphones that are constantly, you know, you get text, you get phone calls. Even when you're not getting texts and phone calls, you look at it, when am I going to get the next text or phone call? We're on tight scheduled, and all of to-do lists and all of the software for organizing our lives just makes us busier and busier because we can pack more in. We need time to do nothing. We need time to sleep. We need time to sit around and veg out in order to let this unconscious incubation process produce ideas. And the ideas don't have to occur just while you're, you know, relaxing. Those during that incubation time, the ideas can churn over and then pop into your awareness later on at some other time.
And you note that it's okay to tell your workplace that you need to take a nap.
Absolutely. You can. I'll write a note if you want, and you can give it to your boss.
But really, for true results.
Absolutely. I'll give you one example. When we had finished the manuscript of the book, we didn't have a title. Every idea for a title, our editor rejected. He didn't like any of these ideas. And, you know, in retrospect, he was right. But we were getting nervous because time was running out and we didn't want to have to push back the publication date because we didn't have a title. So I went to bed early. My wife fell asleep on the couch in the family room. And then at 1 a.m, she woke up all of a sudden and she rushed up to the bedroom. She woke me up and she said, "I got the title. I got the title." I said, "What is it?" She said, "The Eureka Factor." I said, "Oh, that's great. Now I'm going back to sleep." But she got that idea just as she awakened from sleep. And that's the way it works. It often works that way. And our editor loved it. My co-author loved it. And it was a great example of how this process can happen.
So it's important to allow yourself to unplug and to get enough sleep.
It's also important to listen to one's wife, but that's a separate show.
All right, we've got a lot of folks lined up here who'd like to get on the air with you, John Cunios. Let's go to Barbara in Bala Cynwyd. Welcome to Radio Times, Barbara.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Fascinating story.
Thanks.
Fascinating discussion.
So, what's your question?
Oh, well, I just had a story to relate that my grandfather was living in Belgium in 1939, and his younger brother already was in New York, and they were having a party to send his younger sister at 16 to go live with her brother. And the other two children and their families were staying in Belgium, and they had a party. And then after they sent her off on the boat, they passed a shoe store, and someone in the party remarked, "Oh, let's stop in here and buy some boots. And that way, if the Germans invade Belgium and we as Jews have to flee through a forest, we'll be prepared because family members from distant like places in Czechoslovakia were already like showing up and camping out in their homes and even sleeping under the tables." So my grandfather had this eureka moment, like, why should I wait till I have to buy boots and run through a forest? You know, Belgium is not in the war yet, and let's try to leave now. And he bought tickets for the whole family to go to Brazil, which, was a far-off kind of risky, bold thing to do, which many people didn't take that route, and that helped my family survive.
So eureka moments can really be life-changers.
Absolutely. That's a great story. And, in fact, one of the things that I like about that story is that it was sparked by some trivial thing in the environment. So clearly he had been worrying or thinking about this issue of the Nazis potentially invading. And he sees a pair of shoes in the store, and that triggers this whole idea about a plan, about what to do. And that's actually a classic example of how insightful people operate. They when they're not actually working on a problem, they take in a lot of information from the environment. And it could be anything, a stray word, the look on someone's face, something in a store window that then sparks or triggers one of these unconscious insights to bubble up into awareness. So, and people who are more methodical, they don't take in all that information. They're more focused on what's going on in front of them. And they don't necessarily get these triggers that spark ideas, but they get more done analytically.
Barbara, thank you so much for that story. Let's go to Nancy. She's in South Philly. Nancy, you're live on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I've wondered, on the brain scans, does an inaccurate aha moment look any different from an accurate one?
That's a really great question. In fact, in our experiments, there are so few bad insights or inaccurate insights, they're too few for us to study. So now clearly in the real world, people have insights that are wrong sometimes. I mean, a person may have an insight that they're going to commit a crime or something like that. And, you know, that's not good and probably not even right. But with the puzzles that we give to people, when they come up with a solution and it's from an aha moment, it's more likely to be correct than if they had worked through it in a deliberate analytical fashion. And we think the reason for that is that if you're working through a problem deliberately, you might stop too soon. You might declare victory. That's the solution. But if you'd thought a little bit more, you'd realize, no, that wasn't right. But when you have an insight, that's the end product. The unconscious mind has worked through the problem and dumped the solution into your consciousness, and that's it. So that's why, at least with puzzles, people are more likely to be correct when they solve it with a flash of insight. In the real world, that may be a little different.
Hmm. Thanks for the phone call, Nancy, to Radio Times. So, John, if you're stuck on a problem, if you're fixating on it, you say, take a break, walk away from it.
Yes.
And what does that do?
Well, what that does, it does several things, actually. One thing it does is that we're often stuck on a problem because we're thinking about it in the wrong way. And when you take a break and you do something that's very different, you literally start forgetting the bad idea that had gripped your mind. And especially if you change your context and do something that's very, very different from what you were doing, then it makes it easier to forget the bad idea. But there are other things, other possible ways this helps also. One is through a process that's been called opportunistic assimilation. It's an ugly term, but what it means is, think of it this way. When you're hungry, you notice around you food in the environment. You might smell food or see signs for restaurants and all that. However, when you are working on a problem and you fail to solve it, there's a similar sort of mechanism. Your brain stores what we call a failure index. It sensitizes your brain to everything in the environment that has anything to do with the problem. And then you walk around and all of these cues in the environment, your brain is sensitized to anything in the environment that could help you solve the problem, and those things can then trigger an insight. So simply failing to solve a problem sensitizes you to notice things. So if you go out and about and you do things that are very different, you'll be more likely to encounter these triggers that can then spark it. And of course, if you take a break and you take a nap, it's even better.
How does humor play into creative insight?
Well, in a couple of ways. One is that a lot of humor involves insights. Jokes with punchlines that are essentially little insights. You get to the end of a joke, and the tables are turned on you. When you understand the joke, you realize that the first part of the joke you hadn't been understanding in the right way. You get in a new perspective. So a lot of humor, not all humor, but a lot of humor involves a sudden insight. But also, humor puts you in a good mood, which then fosters insights because it expands the scope of your thought. It allows in order to understand humor, you have to be able to grasp these remote wild associations. And in fact, the area of the brain that we see lighting up at the moment of insight, in some people who have had that area damaged through stroke or accident, they have trouble understanding humor. They have trouble understanding metaphors. There's a deep connection between them.
Okay, let's get back to the phones. Ann in Conshohocken, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, great show.
Thanks, Ann,
for taking my call. I had a question with regard to the workplace. Are there professions that you recommend creative types or analytical types pursue, or do you think every workplace needs both folks? And are there ways to make your creative, insightful self a little more analytical when you need to be? Because not every boss really lets you take a nap, and
you know, very few.
Ain't it the truth? Yes.
Thanks, Ann, for the call to Radio Time. Some great questions.
Yeah, I think most jobs need some of both. You need to have ideas, and you need to be able to refine them, critique them, carry them out. Now, the kinds of jobs where you don't have to work for a boss, if you're self-employed, say you're a writer or an artist or something like that, then you can be on your own schedule and just have your ideas. But once you have the ideas, you still need analytical ability to turn it into a product that someone's going to want to buy. In the workplace, you have to be – what's difficult about that is that it's you have to operate on someone else's schedule. And when you're operating on someone else's schedule, then you can't craft these long blocks of uninterrupted time to develop this insightful mindset and have ideas. So what you need to do in that kind of environment is take little breaks and get out of the office, go sit in a park, do something like that. What I do is I wear noise-canceling headphones and sunglasses on the train to work, and I just cut off the environment, and I get a lot of my best ideas that way. Of course, people who are very analytical can find work. I mean, you won't find many accountants who are not analytical. Accountants are not usually going to be poets. There might be some, and you won't find many poets who have as a day job being an accountant. But everyone can do some of both, and it's a matter of separating the blocks of time so that you can do whatever you need to do at that moment, whether it's be insightful or analytic.
Thanks, Ann, for the telephone call. We are talking about the brain science behind aha moments and how to cultivate more of those moments. Our guest this hour is neuroscientist John Cuños, co-author of The Eureka Factor, Aha Moments, Creative Insight, and the Brain. And phones are lighting up here, but I'm sure we can get you in, or we'll try to get you in if you give us a call, 888-477-9499. If you'd like, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at @whyyradiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. And our subject this hour is the aha moment. Neuroscientist John Cuños and a colleague have mapped exactly what happens in the brain when it produces moments of insight and clarity. And he has some advice for us as to how to help our brains produce more. John is co-author of The Eureka Factor, Aha Moments, Creative Insight, and the Brain. And lines are open at 888-477-9499. John, before we get to the telephone calls, it's important, you say, to become aware of your own thought patterns. And part two of this is destructive thought patterns can inhibit flashes of insight. Get into that for us, if you would.
Well, negative thoughts, which create anxiety or stress, it gives you mental tunnel vision. It narrows your thinking. And again, it makes you more analytical, but it also can trap you in sort of this rumination, the cycle of rumination, where your ideas can not stray far from a core topic or theme. But when you're in a positive mood, then the scope of thought expands. So you have to be aware of when you're somewhat anxious or depressed, and you need to be creative. You've got to break that cycle. Do whatever you have to get out of those negative thoughts. Watch a comedy movie. Go out with friends and just be happy. Go to a museum. Anything that it takes to get you out of the bad mood when you have to be particularly insightful. But when you have to be analytical, it's okay to be a little grumpy. I mean, and that, you know, that's fine. You need both.
We've got a question from Susan. She asks, does prayer and meditation help? And interestingly, John, you write, you found that people who believe themselves to be intuitive also tend toward belief in God. How so?
Okay. Well, there are actually two separate issues here, the prayer and the meditation, different things. In terms of prayer, people who believe in God tend to be more intuitive. And what seems to be happening, according to some recent research, is that people who are more intuitive, unconsciously, they're making connections between things. Things seem to be more connected, more unified, more relevant to each other, part of a larger thing. People who tend not to believe in God see things as more disconnected, more separate. They see things as, you know, this doesn't have anything to do with that. They make divisions between things. So the people who tend to believe in God and are more intuitive, they may be more ripe for insights in the sense that they are making these connections, unconscious connections, which can then erupt into consciousness a later time. As far as meditation, there are many different types of meditation, and some of them have very little to do with each other. But some recent research by from Jonathan Schooler's laboratory at University of California, Santa Barbara, looked at one particular type of not specifically meditation, but mindfulness, which is the basis for one type of meditation. And he found, amazingly, that people who are more mindful tend to be more analytical and solve problems less often with flashes of insights. It's the people who are less mindful, who are more scattered in their thinking, who tend to have these flashes of insight. So it's good to be organized, but you know, it's also good to be able to turn that off sometimes and let ideas flow. But some people are more trapped in one or the other way of thinking, and it's harder for them to switch back and forth.
And just in this vein, before we get back to the calls here, you write that many of the world's great religions value insight tremendously for profound transformation by offering a window into transcendental and spiritual realms.
Absolutely. Many of the world's great religions have as part of their scriptures and historical traditions, as well as current practice, the idea that a person can have a sudden epiphany that can essentially have direct contact with God or with some word from God, which then, because of the profundity of the idea, can have a long-lasting or permanent change in the person. So absolutely.
Okay, back to the phones. Deborah in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about how these ideas would apply to children and the learning of children, particularly young children. And, I mean, children usually aren't doing a lot of problem solving per se, well, the way adults do, but they're learning and they're growing all the time. And I was wondering this idea about empty space and what role that plays in their growth and learning.
I'm sorry, the idea about what?
The empty space,
empty
and
space.
Oh, yes.
Looking like you're doing nothing,
mm-hmm.
and how that plays into their learning.
Okay.
Daydreaming.
There are a bunch of questions there. So let's start about with insights in children. Children's brains are different from those of adults. And the reason that adults have insights at all is that our brains are too small, too slow, and have too little information to be able to deal with everything that goes on around us. So our brains are constantly making assumptions. We predict what's going to happen next. And we have a particular theory about what's going on. So you go to a restaurant, the waitress hands you a glass with a clear fluid. You don't have to ask if it's water. You know it's water. You assume it's water. Your brain is always predicting. Insights occur when those predictions are not getting you anywhere, when you're stuck on something because your assumptions and your viewpoint are wrong. And an insight is when you break out of that and switch to a new view of things. Children's brains are less developed, particularly the frontal lobe of the brain, which guides, directs, and organizes thoughts. So sometimes you find that there are situations where very young children can solve problems that slightly older children can't solve, because those older children's brains are more locked into the way adults are, into particular ways of looking at things. So when you're talking about the youngest children, they don't usually have insights. They don't usually need insights because their thinking is kind of all over the place anyway. As you get older, you need insights because you've learned more about the world and your thinking is more fixed. You need that to break out of the box.
Does that help, Carol?
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call to Radio Times. James, you're next. James is in Kimberton, Pennsylvania. Welcome, James.
Ooh, hello. What a fantastic show. I was looking for reflections on the happy accident, Eureka Moments. I worked with Philadelphia inventor Fran McCabe. He was profiled on WHYY's Pulse program. I got a call one night, like 18 months ago or whatever, and the machine that Fran was working on had exploded. It showed way more power than he knew was powerful, but he didn't know that it was like this. And he passed away in the meantime, and this show is fantastic. what else you were talking about was being able to transform back and forth from analytical to the dream state, and he was just amazing like that. Boy, I hated him for his ability to, he would just get mad and stop everything with all these tools scattered everywhere and say, all these tools have to be put away. Before I go crazy, I have to be able to think.
Yeah.
The happy accident thing.
Yeah, a lot of great discoveries occur when something goes wrong or something seemingly trivial happens. And sometimes, in fact, when something goes wrong, what that can do is it can kind of destabilize your thinking. So, you know, we all go about our daily lives, as I said, expecting what will happen next. And what we expect usually does happen. But when our thinking gets destabilized because something goes wrong, that can actually open up our minds to consider possibilities. So in the book, I tell the story about this physicist, Eric Ferlinda, who was visiting the south of France, and he was staying in a hotel, and his wallet, his keys, his computer, and his passport were stolen. And he was stuck in the south of France, nice place to be stuck. And a day or two later, he emailed his brother saying, I just got this fantastic idea for a new theory of gravity. And a couple of days later, he sent his brother all the equations. And his brother even commented how a change of plans, something going wrong, can destabilize your thinking and allow ideas to bubble up that would not have otherwise happened. So those kinds of happy accidents can lead to insights. But also there are other kinds of accidents where something goes wrong and a person has an insight about what that means. What is the significance of that breakdown, that error, that unexpected finding? That can be a trigger for an insight itself.
All right. Thanks for the call to Radio Times, James. Next up, Carol in Wilmington, Delaware. You're live, Carol.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask a question about working with people with different inclinations. Like I would say I'm a eureka, insightful person, and I'll use my spouse as an example. He's very analytical. So when I do have a eureka moment, he kind of poo-poos it and like, even though I must admit, if I must say so myself, my eurekas have been fairly accurate, and the ones that I share with him have been very accurate. So how do you balance that out, and how do you work together with people with different inclinations?
So, John Kuhn, yes, we want you put on your psychologist cap here.
Right. That's a really interesting example because when people who are insightful, they seem to jump to conclusions. That's the way it looks like to people who are analysts. These ideas pop into awareness, and they give these ideas. And for the analyst, it's hard for them to understand where it came from. There's no chain of step-by-step reasoning that leads to that conclusion. And without that step-by-step chain of reasoning, it looks like this was just pulled out of the air. And it can't be right because it didn't result from that kind of analytical thinking. Whereas people who are more analytical, they look at the methodical analytical people. People who are more insightful look at the analytic people and say, you know, they're just kind of, they're mundane thinkers. They just go in a step-by-step linear way. They can't break outside of the box. Everyone has to realize that everyone can do both of that if they give themselves a chance, and they have to respect the other way of doing things. So most problems in life can be solved either analytically or insightfully. Some problems are more easily solved with a flash of insight, and some are better solved analytically. So for example, if you're undergoing surgery for your appendix, you don't want a surgeon who's going to have a flash of insight during the surgery and say, I can take it out this way. No. You want the guy to do it by the book. On the other hand, if the surgery is going wrong, you want a surgeon who can think creatively and have an insight to figure out, how do I make this work even though the book doesn't apply here?
Is that thinking inside the box? And you'd written about Captain Sully Sullenberger and how he had to land that plane in the Hudson a number of years back. That wasn't an aha moment. but he knew so much that he was able to, in a matter of moments, make the correct decision to make the correct course.
Absolutely. Sully is a great example of brilliant inside-the-box thinking, because everything went wrong, but he had 40 years of experience dealing with emergency situations, with everything that could possibly go wrong. And so when his flight, when he had the bird strike and his engines went out and he was running out of power, he just relied on that deep wellspring of knowledge and experience to be able to land the plane safely in the Hudson River. It wasn't an aha moment. It was just great analytical, methodical thinking based on massive expertise.
Okay, let's get to Kathy. She's in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and she joins us live on Radio Times. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much. What a great show. I am or was a musician, and in college I graduated, and I never really had the feel for music. And I went away from music for a couple of years, and I came back, and I started playing again. And my teacher was like, oh, my God, you have the feel. She said, sometimes some people never get the feel. And I was just wondering if it was maybe because my mind was always just thinking a certain way or something. But, I mean, it's beautiful. You know, some, and she said some people never get that feel in music.
You know, that's really interesting, because musicians rarely get worse. They almost always get better with age. And that's both composers and performers. They just get better and better. And part of it is the experience that they gain. But part of it also is that as a person gets older, they develop as a human being. Their emotions become more refined. They have new ways of thinking about life, of structuring ideas in their mind. And I think that, you know, in that case, you just developed as a person. And when you came back to music, you came as a more integrated person and were able to do a better job at it.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you so much. A great show. I'm going to get your book. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Kathy. So as we wrap up the show, John Cuneo's tips to help us have more of those aha moments: get lots of sleep, cultivate positive moods, surround yourself with symbols of inspiration. Also, you have written, it's important to pay attention to that tug your brain is feeding you, your intuition. What's that tug? Does that happen before a flash of insight?
It can happen. We can sometimes sense the presence of an idea that is unconscious and has not yet broken through awareness. Now, what's tricky is that when you have that feeling, it's sort of like almost like you feel like you're going to sneeze, but sometimes the sneeze doesn't come.
And it's frustrating because you can't get it out.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what you need to do is then create the right circumstances to allow that to come out. And that can be quiet surroundings, open spaces, positive mood, expose yourself to different kinds of stimuli, something that might trigger that idea to come out. But also, it's really important, you want to separate out your creative time and your analytical time, because analytical thought can squash creativity very easily. So you want to have open blocks of uninterrupted time to let the thoughts flow.
John Cuneo's, it was a pleasure.
My pleasure.
John, together with Mark Beeman, has written The Eureka Factor, Aha Moments, Creative Insight, and the Brain. And don't forget, if you have a chance, check out our Facebook page and podcasts by visiting whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.